us, and yesterday talked about the Cascade, and today focused in some detail on Mount Rainier and Mount St. Helens. And really, this will be very much a pictorial story, in particular about the Mount St. Helens eruption. I think a lot of us had the opportunity to see some kind of footage at the time, and perhaps some of you have been back to Mount St. Helens since the eruption. But I'm going to talk about the different stages of that eruption and the impact of those different stages. Because we all think of it as one event, but in fact it had a number of parts to it. So the first thing I'm going to do though is start by way of an introduction that might take time. As a review for many of you, just a brief overview for the rest of you, introduce that theory of plate tectonics and why that's important to this story. This theory of plate tectonics says that the surface of our Earth is made up of a number of pieces of rigid material, and you can see the map of them here in this one. It's very dark. You can see this map, which shows us the surface of the Earth. Continents are outlined here. And then the boundaries, shaded by the different colors, are then the different plates which make up the surface of the Earth. The plates bear names that have something to do with geographic features associated with those plates. And the plates that are of importance to us in our story here in the Northwest are the North American plate, a plate which contains both the continent of North America and some oceanic crust, and the small Juan de Fuca plate, which is composed entirely of oceanic crust. You can see there's some very large plates. The Pacific plate occupying much of the Pacific Ocean basin, the Eurasian plate. And one of the things that's interesting is that any one of these plates is, for the most part, a single rigid entity with no particular deformation or activity going on within the middle of the plate. You can see there's some very large plates. The Pacific and Eurasian include vast areas of the Earth, and yet they all move together as single pieces. As I said, we're interested in what's going on just in our corner of the Pacific Ocean. And what is happening, in fact, at the boundary between two plates. And basically, the activity that we find on the surface of the Earth occurs at the boundary between different plates. We have plates moving apart, and these areas that are sort of outlined in red are the ridges where two plates are moving apart, such as the Caribbean plate, such as the North American plate and the Eurasian plate here, South American plate and African plate. That means then that ocean basin is growing as these two plates move apart. There are also places where the two plates come together. These are outlined in blue. These are places where two plates converge. And there we tend to have very active kinds of things going on, both volcanoes and earthquakes. We can look at what happens at these plate boundaries in a cross-section. This is where two plates are moving apart. We have hot new material from the interior of the Earth coming up and being added onto these plates. And so this ocean basin will grow. And then this material travels away from that ridge toward another plate, and the two plates converge. And the result is that one plate always ends up dipping down beneath the other plate, since we can't have the material occupying the same place from two different plates. So our divergent plate boundaries are ridges in the ocean basins, and our convergent plate boundaries, which we find have the features of trenches on the seafloor, and then mountain ranges very often associated with them. And the next couple slides show us how we can distinguish some of these plate boundaries in terms of a couple of other features. We can see these little red dots and blue and green dots represent earthquakes, and you can see that earthquakes occur at plate boundaries, both at divergent plate boundaries, such as these ridges, and then in particular in the regions of the trenches.
How big are these plates? I mean, I know they vary. How thick are they?
Oh, how thick?
Yeah.
About 100 kilometers. So, and it's kind of interesting because when we talk about the Earth, we live on the surface of the Earth, and we tend to think of only that part of the Earth. And yet this outer rind of the Earth, which is made up of these rigid plates, is very small in thickness compared to the rest of the Earth. And it's a great analogy about peach. the earth is layered in the same way a peach is. We have a core to the earth, which is sort of the size in proportion that the pit of a peach is. That the next layer out is called the mantle, and it's material which has some flow in it. It's solid, but it's a ductile kind of solid. And that would then be the fruit of the peach. And then the outermost layer, this crust, which is where the plates are, is then represented by the skin. And the best part of the analogy is that the relief on the surface of the earth would be the same in proportion as the fuzz on the peach.
Wow.
But we live so focused here on the outside of the earth that we sort of don't think of that bigger picture. So earthquakes in the plate boundaries, and also we see volcanoes associated with plate boundaries, primarily associated with our convergent plate boundaries, places where we have two plates coming together with red dots that represent volcanoes. And we can see that this area here has abundant volcanoes associated with it due to the subduction of one plate beneath another. This is then a blow-up, a schema of the detail here in the northern part of North America. We have our this great athletics involved in this in the overhead of this room. Here we have the Pacific plate out here, our small Juan de Fuca plate, and then our North American plate. And along this boundary then, we have two plates converging as the Juan de Fuca plate moves in this direction, and the North American plate moves in this direction. As that material then bends down or is subducted in this oceanic plate, it melts. It goes back down into a hotter interior portion of the earth. It melts, and once it's molten, it's less dense, and so it rises to the surface. And so this is a very common scenario to find a convergent plate boundary. One plate bending down, a trench offshore here, molten material rising, and volcanoes above. And that's true of all of these volcanoes that we find around the Pacific, what we call this ring of fire. We have material melting as it's being subducted and producing volcanoes above. Japan, the Aleutians, these are all products of the same kind of process that's just going on. Now, what we're going to do is look at two mountains in the Cascade Range, Mount Rainier and Mount St. Helens, and talk a little bit about the detail of the history of those regions. Also by way of review for some of you, the history of these Cascades has two parts to it. Early volcanism in this region seems to date to about 40 million years ago. This produced a range of mountains, which was actually west of the present-day Cascades, running down parallel to them called the Western Cascades. And the volcanism at that point lasted for a few million years, and then it ceased, and those older mountains were eroded. And on top of them, we have now built the new range of mountains, slightly to the east, which we call the High Cascades. And we can look at a cross-section of Mount Rainier, which then illustrates this. The underlying, older rocks are represented by all these little hatch marks. This is what a rock that we call granodiorite material, which formed the core of this older mountain range. And then you can see that it was eroded back down to this sort of uneven surface. And then on top of it, we have piled the newer volcanic material, which now forms Mount Rainier. And most of the volcanism associated with the High Cascades, the present-day tall mountains that you see in this range, was only taking place in the last 2 million years. And the Cascades are a very active mountain range. All of the volcanism which has occurred during historic times in the lower 48 states has taken place in the Cascade Mountain Range. So we use various terms to describe volcanoes. There are certain volcanoes which are extinct, there are some which are dormant, and I don't think that the Cascades fall into either of those categories. We simply have inactive volcanoes at the present time. Their activity sort of comes and goes. And those of you who heard yesterday's talk heard that there's been activity in many of the volcanoes in the Cascade Range in the last couple hundred years.
Is
there any explanation for why the earlier volcanism elapsed and it was?
Well, it has something to do with how two plates were moving together, probably, and how that rate may have changed, and the angle of subduction may have changed slightly, and so that it may have been a pulsing kind of a thing, picked up in speed again or something to produce the volcanism. There's lots of speculations about that kind of thing, but it's hard to really pin it down geologically in the past.
The Olympics
are not volcanic. Well, that's not true. The Olympics are not produced by volcanism on a continent. The Olympic Mountains are a very interesting sort of anomaly. They are a bunch of oceanic crust, which was scraped up and added onto the continent. I don't know how many of you have ever driven around the loop around the Olympics, but basically you drive through rock type called basalt almost the entire time you're on that loop. And a lot of the basalt has some formation to it where you see some big round or globular shape to it. And those are called pillow basalts. And that is what happens when basalt erupts underwater. It sort of flows out and forms these pillows where this outer rind cools very rapidly. So it's a really good clue that this was material which formed underwater rather than on land. And then also the sedimentary rocks that you see there are from deeper ocean settings. And so they were scraped up and added on, and I can't remember the date for that. I think it's sometime in the last 10 million years or so that they were added on.
Is this material that you said yesterday that moves upward of the continent? Remember yesterday you said that you have all this material that moves laterally?
You mean adding on these microcontinents?
Yeah.
Well, or these exotic terrains that we talk about, and the Olympics were as well, right? A sort of piece of material that was added onto the continent later. In the same way that this region is here in the North Cascades. Now, I want to talk just a bit about Mount Rainier and about some of the volcanic history and some of the glacial history, and then move on to Mount St. Helens. This is a view of Mount Rainier taken from the south, from Paradise, looking up toward the mountain. It shows a number of the features associated with this mountain, both the sort of volcanic origin to it, and then the huge glaciers which cover the mountain, which I'm also going to talk about. We call this mountain Mount Rainier. It was named by an Englishman for a friend of his, who in fact never even saw the mountain. But in fact, the Indians called this mountain Mount Tahoma, or Snow Mountain, and in some places it still actually gets referred to that way. It was established as a national park in 1899. It was the fifth national park to be established in the United States. It is the highest peak in the Cascades. It is 14,410 feet high. It's interesting, there are a couple of other peaks in the Cascades very close to that, but not quite as high. And in fact, Mount Whitney, which is the highest peak on the West Coast, is only another 100 feet or so high. So Mount Rainier is really quite an enormous peak that we have here. The thing that makes it very dramatic, as I said before, is that it rises out of a mountain range, which is very low in comparison, only on the order of about 6,000 feet. So Mount Rainier really sticks up there in a very dramatic fashion. Mount Whitney is one of a number of similar peaks. Mount Rainier, as in the case of the other high Cascade Mountains, the volcanic history began about 2 million years ago here. It's what we call a stratovolcano. The interlayered material both of flowing rock that came from flowing lava and also from the finer material which came out in blasts such as that which was produced by Mount St. Helens, ash and pumice and things like that. So stratovolcano refers to this layering that makes it up. Stratovolcano also has a very characteristic shape to it. These concave slopes sort of here have been somewhat destroyed, thank you, by some of the glaciation in this area. Mount Rainier's history, though, is complicated by the presence of the glaciers in this area, and so there's some interlayering of glacial debris as well as the volcanic material which makes it up. Now, it is believed that somewhere on the order of 75,000 years ago, Mount Rainier was actually at its peak height at that time, somewhere closer to 16,000 feet. And so Mount Rainier as well has then experienced some sort of an event which made it lose its top in the same way that Mount St. Helens did. And we can see, actually, if we, this is a view now taken from the sunrise side from the east, and we can almost see that perhaps there looks like there should have been something more on top of this mountain to make it into more of the cone shape, which is more typically associated with these stratovolcanoes. It's believed that the summit itself disappeared in some very large explosive eruption on the order of about 6,600 years ago. Similar to the Mount St. Helens event, as geologists look at the deposits to the east of Mount Rainier, they find ash and pumice layers such as those which were produced by the Mount St. Helens eruption. The top of the mountain then has a crater in it, such as similar to that of Crater Lake, which is about 2 miles in diameter, smaller than that little Crater Lake. And as a result of that eruption, various events took place, including mud flows. As the molten material came out, and the heat from that, and the ash and loose debris was released, that combined with the water from the melting glaciers to then flow down the side of the volcano. Some of you are going to be really sick of this slide if you've seen it before. But here we have Mount Rainier, and this is showing us the risk then from mud flows in the present day off of Mount Rainier. A high risk here because there's a lot of water stored on the slopes of this volcano. But at the time that Mount Rainier's top blew off, somewhere about 6,000 years ago, there was a very large flow which made its way down in this direction called the Osceola Mud Flow. Somewhere in the order of about a half a cubic mile in volume of material, which then covered an area greater than 100 square miles. There was human habitation in the area at this time. One of the ways that they can so accurately date the Osceola Mud Flow is because it covered over an old Indian settlement. So they actually can go back and use carbon dating to pinpoint when this took place. And this event is described in Indian legend as well.
Excuse me, where was that at? Where would that be?
What?
Now, the mud flow, Osceola Mud Flow.
It came down this direction and then it's this region right here.
So what's there now?
This is Seattle. This is Tacoma here, Puyallup, Sumner. So Kent is up in this region, so it's slightly to the east of all of that. I'm afraid I don't know my geography completely well enough to be able to tell you. But you can see that because of these other river channels which come down off of the mountain, that there is a risk along those other riverbeds as well. And it's to give me, as a geologist, I live here in an area of risk. It's a nice place to live, but it isn't exactly the smartest place to be. Now, since that eruption, the top of Mount Rainier has started to rebuild again. And there is a small cone which has formed sometime about 3,000 or 2,000 years ago, started to build up again within the old crater formed by the blast which removed the top of the mountain. No eruptions here in the last 100 years. There is some activity, not eruptive activity, but there is steam which is often viewed coming off of Mount Rainier. And fumaroles where you can tell that there is certainly heat very close to the surface at the top. So that is a really good clue that we simply have an inactive volcano rather than one which is simply extinct.
Yeah. What built the new cone inside the crater?
Well, in the same way that there's another cone in small scale eruptions, in the same way that there's the Wizard Island cone in the middle of Crater Lake, and there's a new cone forming inside of Mount St. Helens crater. It's a common thing. I mean, the supply of molten material is returning again, not with the same force that blew the top off, but enough to spew out some new material.
What happened 100 years ago? Did you say nothing had happened?
Yes, in the last 100 years. And part of that is simply because that's kind of the length of documentation. I don't know exactly what happened 100 years ago. Probably only very small scale ash kinds of eruptions, very small things, nothing very dramatic, but the potential is certainly there. It's very Mount Rainier is very, very carefully monitored. There's a lot of devices to measure any earthquakes which take place. 2 years ago at Christmas time, there was an earthquake located somewhere underneath the plumbing of Mount Rainier, perhaps indicating motion of some molten material down in those depths. Temperature and photographs are taken quite regularly to keep track of what's happening up here at the surface. Now, the other thing which is happening in Mount Rainier is the presence of a number of glaciers. And this picture is a very good one to show us some of the topography which has been created by these glaciers. There's a system of 26 glaciers here on this mountain, and we'll look at some of these in a little bit more detail. But one of the things that glaciers do is they carve out valleys, and in between them leave very sharp ridges. And you can see a number of these sharp ridges here in this photograph, and then the valleys that the various glaciers have flowed down. Now, glaciers are simply systems of flowing ice, where the ice is accumulating at a faster rate than it's melting. It's flowing under the influence of gravity, and that's an easy thing to see in this case. It's accumulating up here and then flowing down. And then glaciers have a toe to them where the rate of melt is greater than the supply of ice. This region of North America was covered much more extensively by glaciers in the past. Often we simply talk about the last glaciation, but in fact, over the last 2 to 3 million years, the northern hemisphere of North America was covered, of the whole globe, but northern North America was covered by this ice sheet, as was the northern regions of Europe as well. Today, we're in the phase where this ice sheet has melted and retreated back. It is not gone completely. We still have ice up here in Greenland and in a few small isolated areas. And what we have is a periodicity to this advance of this ice and retreat. On the order of every 100,000 years or so, the ice tends to expand an area and then it retreats back to the smaller areas. We happen to be in what we call an interglacial during one of these times of retreat. The last maximum glaciation was about 10,000 years ago, so we're probably okay in our lifetime. We're not going to get a maximum advance again, but that also had an effect on the topography of Mount Rainier. Just to look in a little bit more detail at our part of North America, we can see that the northern part of the state of Washington was covered by ice, and in fact all the way down in here through the Puget Lowlands, even into the eastern part of the state of Washington. But Mount Rainier, sitting down in this region then, had more ice on it in its past than it does at the present time. This ice was also responsible for carving out Puget Sound, forming a fjord here as that's now been flooded with seawater after the glaciers melted. If we look at the present day glacial system on Mount Rainier, we can see that this is the summit here then, and then flowing away from that summit in all directions, there are glaciers. Coming off toward the Paradise direction is the Nisqually Glacier, can be viewed very easily from Paradise. And coming down towards the Sunrise view is the Emmons Glacier, and I'll show you some photographs of both of those. But you can see that they flow off in all directions. Now, glaciers are important in that they shape the mountain. They also have a very large role that they would play in the potential for mud flows. They are where the stored water is. If there was some event to melt that water very rapidly, it would then cause quite a bit of flooding and also these mud flows. But if we look at a map that shows Mount Rainier during the last maximum glaciation, we see that there was a much more extensive ice cover. The previous map sort of showed just the region of the park, and the present-day glaciers are then here indicated in black. The shaded area then indicates where the glaciers were at the last maximum glaciation, and you can see that it must have carved the topography off on the flanks of the present-day mountain. So, a few slides to then show us what some of these glaciers look like and some of the topography which results from them. Well, that was kind of blank, so that I can show it. This is then a view of the Nisqually Glacier as it comes down towards Paradise. Very classic appearance of the glacier. This very jumbled surface results from the ice cracking as it flows over surfaces these are the crevasses that we see. And you can see this very dramatically carved surface of the rock because the ice has scraped out in between these ridges. Picture also the Emmons Glacier as it flows down towards Sunrise. Again, the surface of it, the cracks and crevasses made by the flow of the ice. You can see here that not only do we have these sharp ridges, but we have these valleys which have a very classic shape to them. The side of this valley here has been carved by a glacier, and if we sort of turn around and look at the other direction, we can see what these valleys look like that were carved by the glaciers that were here during the maximum glaciation. This very classic U shape to it with these sharper ridges in between. So not only do we see active glaciers on Mount Rainier at the present time, but we also see the evidence of the past glaciation as it then sculpted the mountain. So if we were to just talk about what sort of Mount Rainier holds in store, this is a view taken from the south. Again, you can see very dramatic topography that was sculpted out. Mount Rainier certainly has the potential to erupt. Since it has already blown its top off, it would be a long time before we might expect such a large explosive eruption as the one that Mount St. Helens had, but it would not be unexpected to continue to build up the summit of this mountain again in smaller eruptions to increase the size of that cone that's there. Earthquakes are certainly associated with Mount Rainier, as the one was 2 years ago at Christmas. Debris flows, such as the mud flows that I showed you, and the potential for those mud flows, is certainly there today in the present. Any heating event would loosen a lot of water and could sort of transport a lot of material. And not only might it transport solid material, but simply there is a risk of flooding from the melting of any of these glaciers. Of the 6 to 7 volcanoes in the Cascades, which are considered to be those with the potential to erupt sometime in the near future, and that's near geologically and not necessarily in the human time scale. The 6 or 7 that they consider are Lassen, Shasta, Hood, Baker, and Mount St. Helens, as well as perhaps Glacier Peak. Mount Rainier is considered to be one which would be among the most devastating, not because of the eruption itself, but because of this enormous volume of stored water here on the side of the mountain and the potential for the mud flows and debris flows. Nonetheless, it's a pretty gorgeous mountain to look at.
Going back to your earlier comment about the initial volcanic period, are all the low mountains that you see basically
from the earlier
for 40 million years?
That's right.
And so
that's
the peak there is what was created like 2 million years ago.
That's right, in the last 2 million years.
It's really neat. You see all the low mountains.
That's right. And that is what makes, and the Cascades are not unique globally, but that's what makes the Cascades unique on this continent, is this. The other mountain ranges that we have do not have these single peaks that rise up.
Are the lower mountains not made of granodiorite?
That's right. They're
a different kind of formation.
Well, the type of rock which makes up most of Mount Rainier is a rock type that we call andesite. Named, in fact, for the rocks which are found in the Andes Mountains in a very similar kind of setting geologically. And andesite has sort of a counterpart rock to it, which is basically what makes up those underlying mountains. And andesite is a rock which has very, very small crystals in it because it cools very rapidly. And granodiorite is a rock which has fairly large crystals in it because it cools slowly. And in fact, the composition of them are chemically very similar. It's just that here in the eruptions to produce the peaks of the volcanoes, it cools very rapidly. But anything which is moving up beneath the mountain and cooling within the interior of the crust cools very slowly, and so we get the large crystals. So what we see in that underlying rock type from the older mountains is we've eroded off the stuff that cooled very rapidly, the andesite, and now we just see the core of those mountains. And that's, I don't know how many of you may have been in the Sierra Nevada mountains, but that's what we have there too, is what was the core of an old mountain range, which formed by a very similar kind of process. We no longer have those volcanoes on top of it, we just have the big blocks of material that cool slowly in the interior.
What's the explanation for some of the other peaks, like the Homer Peak? I mean, they're
smaller events, side vents. And many of the Cascade volcanoes have sort of some little, I mean, Shasta has Shastina, which sits on the side. And somehow the eruption was being directed off into some side vent. And on Hawaii is a very, very good example of that happening in that type of. It's going to follow the easiest path. And sometimes that easiest path is through something that allows it to come to the crest, and sometimes it makes its way out through some weak zone out onto the side. Okay, I want to spend the rest of the time talking about Mount St. Helens and really just kind of walking our way through or looking our way through visually the eruption that took place in 1980 and talking about the various parts to it and the effects of those various parts. Mount St. Helens is the youngest of the Cascade volcanoes. This is a relief map of the state of Washington. You can see Adams and Lanier sticking up quite dramatically and Baker up here. And Mount St. Helens doesn't show up as high a peak anymore. Sitting over here slightly to the west. This slide was taken before the eruption of Mount St. Helens. Mount St. Helens was always considered to be one of the Cascade volcanoes that had sort of the most classic shape to it, of those that we see in the stratovolcanoes, this concave shape to it coming up to a very nice symmetrical peak. Prior to the eruption, the peak of the mountain was just less than 10,000 feet at 9,677 feet. It was snow covered, but just minimal glaciation. If we compare this to Mount Rainier to start with, it isn't as high, so we're not going to accumulate as much snow and ice. A few small glaciers that flowed off, and those small glaciers played their part in the eruption which took place in 1980. During the last 4,500 years, Mount St. Helens is considered to have been the most active of the Cascade volcanoes. Most of the volcano was probably built only in the last 40,000 years. Ash eruptions and lava eruptions building up once again this layered or stratovolcano. There are Indian legends which talk of eruptions in Mount St. Helens, so certainly in terms of some type of recorded history, there has been something going on here in Mount St. Helens. Geologists can document prior eruptions of Mount St. Helens by looking at the material which came out of these eruptions and dating it and looking at its distribution around the volcano and eastward into the state. There was a major eruptive phase about 150 years ago in the 1850s, during which time a dome was constructed here in the top of the volcano. A lot of ash and loose material was blown out of the volcano. And there's some suggestion that there were some lava flows. There was not a lot of settlement in this area at the time, not a lot of study of the volcano. And so it's not clear whether there was actual lava flow or not up at the top. Since that time, there have been minor steam eruptions which had occurred, 1898, 1903, 1921, but there was no real suggestion of anything going on there in any active kind of fashion. However, two scientists who went out to study the Cascade volcanoes had been doing so for a number of decades. In 1978, published a statement that said that Mount St. Helens has been the most active and most explosive during the last 4,500 years than any other volcano in the conterminous United States, so the lower 48 states. And they named it as the volcano most likely to erupt before the end of the century. Now, it's never been quite clear whether they meant before 2000 or whether they meant in the next century after they made that statement. It's much nicer to say after the fact that they meant before 2000 to enable them to pin it down. This news was certainly disseminated within the geologic community, but public press is never real anxious to publish things like that. And so I don't think that whatever of that information did get out of the public, that anybody paid much attention to it. Mount St. Helens has sat there for a long time, not doing anything, so looking pretty. It was a gorgeous area around it where people could go and have homes and vacation areas. And so they just kind of went on about their way. Now, when did it all begin? Well, March 20th, 1980 was when the first earthquake took place. earthquake of a magnitude 4, enough to be felt in the surrounding area, not enough to really shake up the whole state. And earthquakes then continued during April and May of 1980. Associated with those small earthquakes, there were some small eruptions of ash and steam at the summit. And you can see here then the summit of the volcano covered by this gray coating, one who wants to spin this beautiful white top now, was slightly darkened as small ash eruptions came out. Formation of some of these pits, why do we have that? Well, the heat was melting what's above it. And then debris is sliding back down into those pits. With time, with more heat and more steam coming out, there were the crater at the summit enlarged. And then another process was going on the northwestern flank of the volcano was the formation of this very famous bulge. We can see here the enlargement of the crater, and this side of the mountain was growing outwards. Starting with the earthquakes in March, scientists had been monitoring what was going on with this volcano very carefully and very accurately. In part, they hadn't had the opportunity to do it before, and in part because they realized the potential for risk. This bulge was growing at a phenomenal rate, growing outwards sometimes at the order of 5 to 6 feet a day. By the time the eruption took place in May, it had grown out to be 320 feet high, and it was a bulge of a mile long and a half a mile wide, then sticking out. This signaled that something was going on there, there was some sort of pressure of material moving up in the inside of the volcano. That famous date and time. A picture taken sort of from the same direction, although not on that day of May 18th, shows Mount St. Helens. In fact, this is taken prior to the formation of the bulge, so that we really don't see the bulge showing up. It's a view across Spirit Lake, or the old Spirit Lake, and the bulge was then growing out in this direction. Pictures taken from subsequent directions show some of what took place. The first event that took place at 8:32 a.m. on May 18th, 1980, was an earthquake. Not an enormous earthquake, only a magnitude 5, but something was moving there down inside the volcano, causing this buildup of strain and then the release in the form of an earthquake. And as a result of that earthquake, the first event that took place in what we think of sort of the eruption of Mount St. Helens was not an eruption at all, was a huge landslide triggered by that earthquake. And so the first thing that happens is this side of the volcano simply slides away in one enormous slump. The instability had grown as this bulge had grown out in that direction, and the heating had loosened the snow and had some melting taking place, and so it gave this lubrication. And so what happens, and we'll see some pictures of this material after it flowed down the river valley, the first event then is this giant landslide, and then following that landslide was the most devastating part of the eruption, the blast. This is a picture taken by one of two geologists who just happened to be flying around in an airplane. They are real lucky that when they took this picture, they were on the east side of the volcano rather than over here on the north side of the volcano. So this is the blast. Huge pressure had built up. And what happens with the blast is a cloud of steam and ash came out of the north side of the volcano. This one is then taken from the air. A series of photographs were taken from the north side from an area called Bear Meadow. Any of you who have been to that area, this showing the blast.
How far away?
Just, I don't know. I can't remember what it is. It's 3, 4, 5 miles, something like that. Real lucky people. This was a campground in National Forest, and people were camped out there. You can see that the remains of this huge landslide, this cloud of dust thrown up by the huge landslide, as it moved off in that direction down the valley, and now the blast is coming out northward. This huge cloud of steam and ash is blowing in this direction with this enormous heat behind it. I actually don't have an estimated temperature. I can't remember. The temperatures are estimated somewhere 300, 400, 500 degrees. Blast moved out in the velocity of about 700 miles an hour. traveled out, and what we'll see in a map, out in the direction to the north, covering a huge area. Associated with this blast was then about a third of a cubic mile of material being blown out of the inside of the mountain. This is one of the first photographs, and then you can see as this blast, the material coming out, travels away, it increases in its size, and it's traveling northward over these ridges. Following this, then, was the sort of third phase of the eruption, which is the vertical ash cloud. Now, this is, as I said, this blast is really the most destructive part of the volcano, of the eruption of the volcano, and it was this blast, this huge force of energy blowing out, which is what flattened all of the trees, and I'll come back and show you some slides of the flattened trees. Flattened all of the trees and charred off all of the vegetation that was the greenery growing on those trees. This is a fairly close-up view of now what is the third phase, this vertical ash plume, which was the part of the eruption which then continued on for a number of hours. The landslide which took place happened almost instantaneously. The blast happened very close to instantaneously as it traveled at such high speeds. And then basically after that material had been blown off the side of the mountain, the material had slid down and then the rest had blown out, what continued after that was this vertical release of ash up into the sky. Another picture showing it from slightly greater distance. A cloud somewhere between 12 and 15 miles high. And we all know that if you lived in the eastern part of the state, this is what you thought was the most devastating part of the eruption, as this huge cloud of ash blew eastwards and covered various parts of the state in up to many number of inches of ash. The eruption of this ash continued for about 10 hours, and this is really the footage that most of us got to see when it showed up in newsreels and so on, what people were actually able to get coverage of this. There is no continuous coverage of the blast, there are simply a series of these photographs, such as I showed, showing this cloud moving outwards in the blast. Now, this next slide that I have then shows the mountain shaped before and after. You can see that one of the results of this blast was the formation of a huge crater now at the top of the mountain. The crater was on the order of only a mile in diameter, so smaller than that associated with Mount Rainier. Probably less material that was blown out of Mount Rainier. So I said it was about a third of a cubic mile blown out of Mount Rainier. When Crater Lake blew, there were about 10 cubic miles of material which were released, producing a crater about 5 miles in diameter. Yellowstone also sits, Yellowstone National Park sits on a huge crater from a volcanic eruption. There were probably 100 times as much material released from that eruption. So Mount St. Helens is pretty small, although it's the one that we all are familiar with, and so the one of fair drama. You can then see the original shape in terms of the summit. After the eruption, the mountain was then 1,300 feet lower than it had been previously. Present elevation is somewhere in the order of 8,300 or so feet. As I said, there was a system of glaciers which had built up on this mountain. There were 11 different glaciers, and those melted with this eruption, releasing a lot of water, causing mudflows around all sides of the volcano, not only to the north, where so much of the material slid. I have just a series of drawings which have been put together to sort of show what happens here. You can see this is the early, this is the mountain before the eruption. Here's Spirit Lake, which had so much coverage, and then the valley of the Toutle River moves off in this direction. A drawing sort of during the eruption, showing us a number of the different parts, this huge flow of material coming down this direction, the debris flow, and then the gas and ash cloud of the large blast moving off here, and then a drawing sort of what the mountain looks like afterwards, the large crater at the top, the mud and debris flows that make their way down through the valley, and then here is this enormous area of the blast zone where all of these trees were flattened. So the trees gave a very interesting sort of set of documentation of how the blast had moved out. how it actually flowed up over ridges and down into valleys. The orientation of the trees was actually studied in some detail by scientists to understand more about how these blasts take place. Many of us know sort of the human impact side of this eruption. There were 57 people who died as a result of this eruption. We're very lucky that the eruption took place at 8:30 in the morning rather than at 10:30 or 11:30. There probably would have been another few hundred people in there who were had been given permission the next morning to go in and rescue their possessions. Somewhere on the order of 10 million trees were destroyed by this eruption, and as many as 2 or 3 inches of ash fell in central and eastern Washington following. It's estimated that the energy from this eruption of Mount St. Helens was on the order of about 27,000 Hiroshima bombs. So while we've seen the damage that a few bombs can do, the damage of an eruption such as this is enormous, and if we think of what the damage must have been like to the area following the eruption of the mountain to form Crater Lake, it must have been quite spectacular. I can't remember what slide I have. Well, this now shows us a map view to show the different areas that were impacted by different kinds of things. There was flooding down here in the lower part of the tunnel. As I said, a lot of water was released from the heating. Mud flows came down through these valleys on the northwest side and also off onto the south and east as well. And I'll show some pictures of what the mud flows look like in the north fork of the tunnel. This shows us then the area where the trees were flattened, and I have some pictures to show of that as well. The blast itself came out in this direction.
So there's no more Spirit Lake?
Yes, there is. And I'm going to show you a picture of that. Spirit Lake sort of got moved. This is, in fact, a picture of Mount St. Helens. After the eruption, you can see that there is still a lake here. This is Spirit Lake. The old Spirit Lake sat in a depression that was slightly westward of where the present one is. All the material which came out of the mountain sort of filled in part of that old depression and forced that water to move over to another location. You can see that we are in an area where there are trees standing, but as we get closer to the mountain, there are no trees here. These were all flattened by this blast of material that came out at the initial eruption. And this is taken fairly soon after the eruption, a crater with nothing down here. At the bottom of it, pictures of the present-day mountain show us that there has now been a new dome forming within that. This shows then the flattened of the trees. You can see that any of the greenery on the trees was simply seared off by the heat of this blast. And then these trees are all lined down. We're actually out here almost, I think, we must be closer to the edge of the blast zone because there are still a few standing trees. As you move in toward the mountain, there are almost no standing trees at all. Another view, this is actually taken only last summer, so this is 10 years afterwards. You can see the mountain here, the crater opens off in this direction. Flattened trees, but then you get out toward the edge of the blast zone, and the trees lost their vegetation. It was charred off, but there are still a few standing trees out of that region. And if you kind of turn around and look the opposite direction, you can look back into where there are standing trees that are covered with greenery. It's really quite a dramatic thing to drive into the northeast side of Mount Rainier down to an area they have called Windy Ridge. You're driving through huge forests, huge tall green trees, and then just like that, you drive out of the blast zone. So no warning. You come around the curve, and there you are with flattened trees and just a few charred stumps. One of the things that you can see, though, here, as we look at this, what is here right just at the edge of the blast zone, are all of these smaller trees, which are now growing back in what was taken a little over 10 years later. They're the source for the seeds of those are coming from the standing trees here. You'll see that when we look at some of the pictures taken out further out into the blast zone, there wasn't the source to replant these trees naturally. One of the other things that you see in this diagram are all sorts of layers of ash here in the hillside. And it's these layers that geologists had studied to document the previous eruption history of Mount St. Helens. You can see each layer sort of representing a different eruption.
Is that land fertile?
Usually volcanic debris is fairly fertile. It's got all sort of the right ingredients in it to make it fertile. But the problem is how you get something to start there, to colonize there. You don't have any source for it. in the way of seeds.
Did any people in the blast zone survive?
No.
How close was the closest survivor?
Probably actually the people who took those photographs at Bare Meadow that showed the blast. I think they were among their closest.
3 miles was
there. Well, I'm actually, I keep trying to think sort of to my what it is. Probably more like 5 miles or so, but I can't remember exactly. This is also, it gives an interesting perspective. You can see that here we're in a region where the trees were all flattened in the blast zone. And then you can see that there's just a very sharp edge. It traveled so far before it burned, it used up its energy, and then these trees are still standing. Where did a lot of these flattened trees go? Well, a lot of them washed off of the slopes and down into Spirit Lake. This is the present-day Spirit Lake. It's bigger than you think it is. You see the blue of the lake, but in fact the lake extends out here, and there's this huge mat of floating logs on the surface of Spirit Lake. They drift around as winds move them around within the lake. This is one view, sort of from the northeast. You can see the crater in here, although it's sort of filled in with some cloud and steam, looking across the present-day Spirit Lake. And another view taken, looking, the mountain sits off here to our left and looking sort of northwest across Spirit Lake, and again you can see some of the log mat and all of these flattened trees. And this is a picture that was taken last year, so you can see that not much has changed. One of the things that happens is that Mount St. Helens is in a national forest. There was some trade between Weyerhaeuser and the National Forest for land, and basically the National Forest will now simply preserve this land untouched from that day onward and see what happens in a natural sense. As you drive into this area of Windy Ridge, you drive along a road where Weyerhaeuser owns the land on one side and the National Forest owns the land on the other side. And it's kind of interesting to compare what happens in that region. Weyerhaeuser has a lot of the land where trees were flattened, and the story is that the Tacoma Dome, and you probably know the Tacoma Dome, largest wooden structure in the United States, that the exterior shell of that is made in large part by wood which came from the blowdown of Mount St. Helens. It had a deal on it, it was already dry, right? And Weyerhaeuser then cleared the land and the logs off of the land that they own, and the National Forest is then preserving the land which they own. As I mentioned, the mudflows, I just have a few pictures to show this landscape resulting from where these were flowing down the valleys. Often described as a moonscape, we are in fact looking at a river valley where all this debris and mud was carried down it, away from the mountain. And I think the mountain is kind of over in that direction in this picture.
What are all the craters in that?
Well, it's not so much craters as it is blocks of material. We think of mud flows as just being fine clay or soil, but in fact it would sort of transport any big block of material in its way. And so as the debris moved down, it just sort of took it and transported it as these big pieces floating along in the finer slurry of material. I mean, it's really kind of eerie picture. It doesn't look like it belongs on the surface of the earth. Those pictures were taken shortly after, and this picture as well, you can see the river valleys are just filled with debris. This is a picture which was taken only last year, and these river valleys are still filled with debris. It will be a long time before they sort of get cleaned out. This is a picture actually taken the following July, reminding us that while the big blast took place in May, that the eruptions didn't cease immediately, and as I mentioned, that there's been this rebuilding of this dome within the crater of Mount St. Helens. Slowly rebuilding, not much activity in the last 3 or 4 years.
Is that all steam?
Steam and ash, primarily steam, but some ash as well. And then just a little bit of sort of hope for the future. This is a picture taken close to where the miner's car is on the driving the Windy Ridge. For anyone who's been there, you can see this is an area where the trees were all flattened, but vegetation is starting back. This is fireweed. Obviously, it likes to go back into colonized areas where everything was burned out. And yet you can also see up in these pockets, there is green here as small plants start to come back and recolonize in the area. Close up, that's lupin growing, and then we're looking across mudflow material over there.
Is that mud and debris, was that inside that pyroclastic?
And also in some of the subsequent flows of the loose material. I mean, any of the ash that was erupted got swept down by water from the melting glaciers as well. So,
so that process followed the initial blast.
Mm-hmm. Some of that did, and some of that was part of the debris avalanche from beforehand as well.
Was there any actual lava flow?
No, no lava flow at all. And then I think this is my last picture, just one to show that, in fact, trees are starting to grow back in there as well. It, particularly in sheltered areas, often on the back side of a ridge is where we start to see the first trees starting to come back, because this is an area where maybe the seeds weren't charred quite so badly, and so some of them were actually able to start growing. Okay, just a little narrative there. At this point, I think I'm pretty sure that is my last slide.
What are the natural trees in that area?
Mostly it's white pine is what these are. Yeah.
What about the mud flows? How long does that how long does the temperature stay up in that, or when does it stabilize? Does it take months to cool down?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't know the answer to that. I could give you a guess. The surface would cool fairly rapidly. I really actually can only speculate maybe weeks.
They're quite deep, wouldn't they? I mean, maybe 100 feet deep.
That's right, and probably weeks to months to cool down in the bottom of those mud flows. Mud is great insulator. Yeah.
What was the timing of the other phases? You said the first one, the earthquake?
Minutes.
Oh, okay.
I mean, the blast traveling at 700 miles an hour came up pretty fast. Yeah.
You said there was no lava, and I'm curious to know the cone that's building now, what's it building at?
Well, some of that is kind of pressure, and some of that is actually material seeping out. But most of it is just sort of a pressure building up again from underneath. But no lava flows in the way that we think of from Hawaii associated with this eruption. And that cone building up again has taken place after this, the May eruption. You know, we think of the Hawaiian volcanoes as they are lava flowing out in their eruptions. And that's not a part of this one. You have more to that question.
Well, so what is the cone made of that's growing now?
Well, some of it is lava, and some of it is probably ash building up and cinders building up to build a small cone.
So is it possible that if there was another eruption, it would be a lava eruption?
It is possible, because the sequence in these volcanoes appears to be ash interlayered with lava flow. The only volcano where there's been a lava flow in the last 150 years, I think, is Lassen, where it's actually been observed and documented.
Okay. Are the one in Japan and the one in the Philippines, where they
switched? Yes, and so is the one in Alaska. That's right. All very similar kinds of eruptions, more in the way of ash and steam than in the way of actual lava. And that's why the Alaskan one, I mean, it's very dramatic in terms of impacting flight paths for airplanes, because it puts all this fine, coarse stuff. Yeah.
So how hot did the mud flow get? I guess I pictured it with all that frozen stuff from the glaciers, it was just tepid, but maybe
that's no. Quite warm. I can't give you a number, unfortunately. I might be able to later. There are just a little bit of literature. This one is one I mentioned earlier on in the week. It's a great book to kind of summarize what's happening at all the different Cascade volcanoes, called Fire Mountains of the West. That's over here in the bookstore. There's some other ones which are available from various places, particularly the national parks. All the national parks put out these ones. This one's called Mount St. Helens. There's one similar about Mount Rainier. They have great pictures and a little bit of history. And then two publications put out by the United States Geological Survey. This one, it recounts the first 100 days of activity, and this one sort of summarizes past and present and future eruptions, potential for Mount St. Helens. I could probably look in here and find a number. I want to tell you a number sort of on the order of a couple hundred degrees, but that's probably centigrade. So I can't, that's... Other questions?
Did you mention the relative size of the blast that formed crater like Mount Mazama?
Yes. I mentioned it in terms of the amount of material blown out. This produced a crater a mile in diameter, about a third of a cubic mile of material blown out. Crater Lake, the crater is, except it's called there, but that's okay, it's 5 miles in diameter. and about 10 cubic miles of material. So, 30 times bigger.
How about, are you, know the details on the volcano in the Philippines?
No, I couldn't tell you how that compares in size. I think it's probably more like St. Helens.
I'm just curious, it spewed ash for weeks, didn't it?
Right, and actually, certain amounts in St. Helens. I mean, the first event was big.